Hello, good evening, and welcome to Seascapes. On tonight's programme, Ireland's first ever woman Navy diver, more on that last-minute Brexit fisheries deal, and a disastrous crash for the USA team in the America's Cup in New Zealand. Sub-Lieutenant Talia Britton made history last year when she became the first woman to join the Naval Service Diving Unit. From Rosnaula in County Donegal, she's currently Gunnery Officer on the Ellie James Joyce. Lorna Siggins was in the Naval Base in Haulbowline, watching aspiring divers undergo the grueling aptitude test which Talia had to complete before qualifying for the diving training course. Head of the Naval Service Diving Unit, Stephen Stack, explained what's involved.
Okay, right hand over, covering the face mask, and your DV. Okay, there in front, there behind, big step off into the water. Right, over to the shot line, get your hand on the shot line.
I'm on a pontoon on a bright, cold winter's morning at the naval base in Haulbowline, Cork Harbour. With me is Stephen Stack, head of the Naval Service Diving Unit. It's regarded as the water equivalent of the Army Ranger Wing. Two aspiring divers are being put through very tough paces to see if they might qualify for an intense 11-week training course to become a Navy SEAL.
One hand in the lifeline, one hand in the shot line. Go, diver, strong. Like we said a while ago, be aware of boat lines. Do not get yourself wrapped up because it's going to impede in our descent coming up. Understood? Vent up, check for leaks. You have to continue. Leave surface.
So it's a two-day assessment. We run the candidate through a series of water fitness tasks, diving tasks, and a fitness test. The purpose of it is to assess their overall comfort levels in the water itself and their aptitude to conduct the naval diving course. So the instructors will be monitoring the divers' comfort levels in the water, and there's a series of tasks to complete. The most significant one is to be able to clear a flooded mask. So the diver has to be able to do that underwater.
Just feel about on the end of that line at all times. Don't stop going down, okay? Don't pull them up. Once you can feel them at all times, that's all they want.
Yes.
Understood?
Yes.
Let me go when he gives you one pull.
Keep that in your mouth. Keep breathing from it. Don't take it out of your mouth again, Diver O'Malley. Do you hear me? You need to breathe through that. That's the only thing that you need to breathe through. Don't take it out of your mouth again. All right. Now, shot line, this blue one, keep a hold of. You are twirling around that line. All right? Sort yourself out. You ready to go? I'm going to drop you down the meter.
You won't pull yet. Is he travelling?
Sub-Lieutenant Talia Britton made history last year when she became the first female to join the Naval Service Diving Unit, qualifying along with able mechanic Rob Mulqueen and able seaman Emmett O'Halloran.
My name's Talia Britton and I'm a lieutenant in the Irish Naval Service. I'm from Rosnaula in County Donegal. I was very, very lucky. I grew up literally only 200 metres from the beach here in Rosnaula, where I suppose I was introduced to like surfing and swimming and surf lifesaving. So that kind of started my love for the water. I did quite a lot with surfing growing up, so it was actually really nice. Had a couple national championships when I was under 18. I kind of just followed that up then until I was about 21. I kind of stopped competing because I went to college and I just didn't really find that I had as much time. I studied podiatry in NUIG. I always wanted to join the military growing up, but my family kind of wanted me to go to college first, but I literally finished my degree and I was like, yeah, I'm still joining. Yeah, currently serving as the gunnery officer on the Ellie James Joyce. So the diving aptitudes, they're kind of introduced just to see if people are suitable for actually just advancing onto the course. They kind of give you a taster into what your days on the course will be like, just to see how you fare. But you have to be able to do one specific thing, which is just clearing your mask. So you're actually sent underwater just to see how comfortable you are underwater. I think they introduced it into the aptitude because it might be one thing that people might realise, no, this isn't for me, because it mightn't be comfortable. A lot of people find the water around their nose. it's just not something they can control.
Yeah. Why didn't they break the surface first? Why did your thumb not break the surface first?
I forgot, yeah.
You forgot. Is that any good, Tiff? There's a boat coming over and topped your head off, is it?
No.
No. Was your eyes or hand gun in her head?
Yes.
Okay, I've told you already, don't let it happen again.
Yes.
No, listen up to me. The next phase is your mask clearing phase, okay? The first part of it is, I'm going to leave you go down a few feet, okay?
Yes,
as you're instructed, you're going to tilt the mask off your face, fill it with water, okay? Once that's done, you're going to come up, show me it's full. Go back down a few feet and clear your mask. Clear your mask as you're instructed by taking a breath of air, okay? Breathe in through your mouth. With the palm of your hand, press the top of your mask, breathe out through your nose. That will clear the air from your mask. Understood?
Yes,
any questions?
Okay.
Are you happy to continue?
Yes, sir.
Leave surface. Right, hold him here now. Breathe normally. Once more.
Yeah, obviously remaining calm would be... it's obviously very important, you know, because, like, obviously if you panic, there's nowhere else to go, you know, like, I suppose you're thinking about all the water that's around you. The Naval Surface Diving Section, they do different things. Like, I suppose a lot of people think straight away of, like, search and recovery. But, like, there's obviously different aspects. That could be, like, ship surveys, ship bomb searches, just key wall searches. It was actually straight after my course. We were called out on a search and recovery. I suppose it made my training very real. I suppose I was very anxious to prove that I was able to do the work with the other people in the diving section, who especially with those who trained me. You know, like, I'd like to think that I don't feel any different than any person that's ever passed the course before, especially like the two lads that I did the course with. That, like, that overwhelming pride and joy just for having completed it and just gotten through the hardship and everything else. Really nice feeling to think that, yeah, I made this step for other women, other water women, in that kind of a way. That even this year, I think they've had an awful lot of applicants for the diving course this year. You know, like, I'll take it all as it comes. I was like, I still had to do everything that all the lads had to do. You know, I didn't find it easy by any means, you know, so best of luck to anybody who wants to try for it anyway.
When you get there, stand by neighbours there. You've plenty of his down there, so don't panic.
So clearing the mask, that's, you have to do that fairly regularly, do you?
Oh, yes. The reason being because we dive in quite often in nil visibility during search operations. So we could be in a river and you could swim into a submerged tree or shopping trolley or something like that, and your face mask could get shifted and it could flood. You need to be able to clear it underwater. No.
This is all very tough.
It is, yeah. On average, the course has a 70% failure rate, and that's once the course starts.
Can you come back and do the course again?
Oh, yes. Right. Say, for this course, we started aptitudes in October, and we were running them every Tuesday and Wednesday of each week. So if a guy or a girl failed on the first week, there's nothing to stop them coming back the following week or the week after. And even likewise, for the course itself, if somebody gets onto the course and fails the course, it can come back to the following year and attempt it again. Yeah.
People often assume that diving is completely, it's all physical. Everything that I need, that even people prepare for, they prepare for the physical side. It's going to be so tough and strenuous in your body, and it is. Don't get me wrong. It really is. Like, I came out black and blue for after my course, and I had aches and pains, and now I'm just cribbing. But so much of it is mental. Like, yes, it's difficult and it's strenuous on your body, but generally that's when you're on the surface getting into or getting out of the water. But you spend most of the time, if you think about it, under the water, under the surface, and you're completely left alone there in the dark with your own thoughts. And, like, trying to deal with the cold in some cases. And you have to be able, I think, to either completely clear your mind and switch off, or else have complete control over your thoughts. Like, the amount of time that you spend alone underwater with your own thoughts is not something people take into consideration beforehand. And like, depending on the person, the mental game can be up to 70-80% of a diving course, or just being able to tackle that aspect. Like, I do think it was different for me, because a lot of the mental strain on myself by worrying whether I was going to be strong enough or fit enough or capable of completing a task. Having a group of people around you is key. Like, everyone has good days and bad days, but like, you do need that support of knowing that other people are going through the same hardship as you. Like, I know people say like misery loves company, but like, when you consider that you spend up to 5 hours underwater per day, you'd have to be mad, or some people think that you're mad to do this kind of course, just to be that alone with your thoughts for that amount of time. So much so that like, people often ask, oh, what do you think about when you're underwater? Some divers, I asked before my course even started, is like, you know, what do you do? How do you mentally prepare for it? And they're always like, they always do say, you take it dive by dive, generally. Day by day, dive by dive. Like, if you ask some people, they'll tell you, like, they'll happily sit underwater singing songs to themselves. It's literally just to occupy your time, and just in some ways you think it's to keep yourself sane. But the more that I'm saying this out loud, I probably sound like a crazy person. And I know now you're going to ask, like, what did I sing underwater to myself? Part of me doesn't even want to say it. It's so embarrassing. But I did have a song that was stuck in my head for the duration of the course. I think I had the two lads in my course, I think I had their heads absolutely wrecked. But do you know that film, Moana? Well, Dwayne Johnson sings a song called You're Welcome. And for up to 8 months, that song was stuck in my head every single dive. Don't know why, couldn't get rid of it. And it was just constantly there.
Okay. I see what's happening, yeah. You're face to face with greatness and it's strange. I know it's a lot, the hair, the bod. When you're staring at a demigod, what can I say except you're welcome? For the tides, the sun, the sky. Hey, it's okay, it's okay, you're welcome. I'm just an ordinary demigod.
And the next time you're somewhere on a boat, wet and cold, and pretending you're enjoying yourself, I bet that song will be going through your head. Best of luck to Navy diver Thalia Britton, speaking there to Lorna Siggins. The Brexit fisheries deal, signed at the last minute on Christmas Eve, has been met with dismay by fishermen here. It was discussed in the Dáil this week when the government voted down a motion opposing it. Donegal Independent TD Thomas Pringle has been vocal in his opposition to the deal. He told me why.
People were led to believe that the government was going to fight on behalf of fishermen and that it was going to be an intrinsic part of any deal that was going to be made with the UK on their leaving the European Union. And it turns out once again that the Irish fishing industry has been shafted by Europe, and it seems with the cooperation of the Irish government as well.
Yeah, because even Simon Coveney said fisheries really essentially had been sacrificed. He didn't use those words, sacrificed for the rest of the economy.
Yeah, and that was always going to be the case. The Irish government has always operated on that basis within Europe, for the fishing industry. It goes back to even when we were negotiating to join the European Union, the EEC, as it was then, where they made the conservation of fishing stock the sole responsibility of the European Commission in advance of us joining. That was to get control of our fishing resources, and we were quite happy to go along with that.
It hasn't changed since. What's going to be the impact in your constituency?
The impact is going to be huge in Donegal. Like, with the reductions in mackerel, catching and landings, killing eggs are totally based on mackerel, and the whole fish processing sector and the catching sector are based on that one stock, and an immediate impact as well, because the cuts are taking place right away. So anything the government talks about doing now won't help the fishing industry or the workers in the factories over the next couple of months. You know, and it's basically the crews and the factory workers are the ones that are going to suffer the most in relation to this.
What exactly are the cuts?
The cuts are massive. It means that there's overall there's a 15% cut in Irish quota over in its entirety, which is actually the highest cut that the European Union has suffered. Ireland and Germany have cut by 15%. For example, France has only a cut of 7%. The Netherlands a cut of 10%. So that's huge. And then within that, then the 24% of that cut is made up of mackerel quota, which is a huge cut that the mackerel has been declining. It's kind of been going up and down over the last 10 or 15 years with the effect of quota and stuff like that. And that has an impact because mackerel is the most viable part of the fishing industry and the for factory workers and that, and for crews as well. So it's going to have a huge impact on their income in the future.
We've been speaking to fishermen on this programme several times. They don't want compensation. They want to be allowed to keep fishing.
Yeah, fishermen want to keep fishing. That's the reality of the situation. And that has always been the way. And plus, the compensation won't go to the crews. Compensation will go to the boat owners, and that's the only people that will benefit from it. And that's we saw even during the COVID that the government turned around and said, well, the crews have the dole and they can go on the dole. They don't have to. They don't need the COVID payment, you know. And that's the reality of the situation. So compensation will benefit the people who own the boats at the moment, but the crews will be left, and the workers and the factories will be gone as well.
What has government been saying to you about this? You've had a dole debate. You have an agricultural committee meeting today.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, I mean, the government are very sensitive to criticism in relation to this. So it's obvious that they didn't do their job when it was when the negotiations were taking place, and they let the eye off the ball, and they're very sensitive now to any criticism in relation to that. And the minister is talking about that he's going to set up a working group to look at it, but that's, to be honest with you, that means nothing. And I mean, it means basically kicking the ball down the road, and that we might see some results or some comeback of it in 2 years' time. And he's also then talking about the common fisheries policy is up for review now as well. But I would seriously doubt whether Ireland has the will to get changes to the common fisheries policy, or even the ability, because Europe has always taken our fish as being theirs, and they're not going to give that up. I think if we had done the proper deal when we joined the European Union in the first place, we would have a far more balanced regional development right across the country, and we wouldn't be Dublin-centric in the entire country. And that's would be the benefit that we have made from our fishing industry if we'd have looked after it and done it properly. Now, we're in catch-up on this stage, and I don't know whether it's too late now, but I would definitely be fighting to make sure that it's not, and I'm doing my best to make sure that that is the case. If you look at it, and these are European Union figures themselves, the European Union has estimated that the value of fish taken out of Irish waters since we have joined the European Union by other European countries is 120 billion euros. And the total value of structural funds and every income grant that we've got from the European Union in the same period is only 45 billion. So who is the gain? Who is paying for the European Union? We are.
Donegal TD, Thomas Pringle. The America's Cup is the biggest prize in sailing, and it's ongoing in New Zealand at the moment. This week, it saw its spectacular crash involving the USA entry. Maurice O'Connell is a well-known pro sailor, sailmaker and an Olympic coach. He's also RTE's sailing analyst, and I spoke to him earlier today about the America's Cup.
Well, Fergal, the America's Cup is the oldest international trophy in sport. It has an allure that has drawn some of the biggest names in sailing and some of the wealthiest patrons and people in the world to try and challenge for it. It's also unique in that it had the longest winning streak also in international sport when the Americans retained the Cup for 132 years. It's an extraordinary event. It's run every 3 years or so, and it's been run continuously every 3 years since 1851.
It's ongoing in New Zealand at the moment. Who's competing? Because New Zealand hold the trophy.
Yeah, New Zealand are the defenders. There were about six teams put together challenges for us following the 2017 event. That whittled away slowly to three teams are left. So there's the British team, which is led by Sir Ben Ainslie, the greatest Olympic sailor ever. He's won five Olympic medals across five Olympic Games. They are one of the challengers. Then there is Prada Pirelli Luna Rossa, from Italy. And then the third challenger are the Americans, Team American Magic. And they are backed by the New York Yacht Club. So those three teams are the three challengers that are left that are challenging for the right to go forward and race for the America's Cup against the New Zealanders.
The budgets and these things are enormous, at least $100 million. But yeah. The boats themselves, they look almost like aircraft rather than yachts.
Yeah, like I guess it's amazing, like for sailors like ourselves, you know, the development in the sport has been phenomenal in the last 10 years, you know, and that these boats, Fergal, are, you don't just sail them, you fly them. And they're effectively hydrofoiling sailboats, where once the boat reaches a certain speed, the hydrofoils that are underneath the water generate, you know, extraordinary hydrodynamic lift, and they lift the entire boats out of the water, and thus the drag gets massively reduced, and literally they just take off with just the tiniest little bit of the boat in the water, which are the two foils.
And so they're doing about 40 knots, which is faster plus, than a speedboat.
Yeah, I think one of them hit 47 or 48 knots the other day. And like that is just unheard of. And of course, it brings extraordinary danger.
You can see that when people are saying it, they're all wearing crash helmets. And the other day, the American team had a spectacular crash. They almost took off.
Yeah, yeah. It's probably the most spectacular moment in America's Cup history when American Magic rounded the windward mark ahead of the Italians. And you know, it's like any, you know, catastrophic failure like that. There's no one thing ever to kind of point your finger at. But
somebody forgot to let go a runner.
Well, somebody forgot to let go a running backstay.
Hands up who's not guilty.
Yeah, there was, you know, like there was that. And then there was a little bit of hesitation in the team on board as to what manoeuvre they should try and do. At the same time, you know, 5 seconds before it happened, there was only, I'd know, something like 12 or 13 knots of breeze. And then there was this massive squall came down the left-hand side of the course. The breeze went up to 23, 24 knots. And the combination of all that thing meant that the boat just became unbalanced and literally took off, left the water because they weren't able to depower the sail plan enough. And of course, when it left the water, it lost grip. And then the boat skidded to the side and then crashed over and capsized. So, you know, of the 11 people on the boat, you know, 5 or 6 of them were immediately underwater. So they had to cut themselves free. And each of the sailors has about 2 minutes of oxygen in a tank on their back so that they can stay underwater if this sort of thing happens. But they don't have very long before they you know, they really need to get out of there. So it was a heart stopping moment for everybody around the world who was watching it, because nobody likes to see anybody being in danger. But from the American Magic's perspective, they destroyed the boat.
There's a huge hole in it.
There's a massive rectangular hole in it. And there was a lot of chat that this is a battery that had come loose. But Terry Hutchinson, the chief executive and the skipper of the team, said in the debrief that it was literally as a result of the hull smashing into the water with such incredible sideways force that it literally just pushed one of the panels in the hull through and just created this hole. So not only, you know, did the boat capsize, and it was, you know, it was also sinking. And if it wasn't for the help of all the other syndicates who, you know, who went to the rescue of them, but they all had pumps on each of their chase boats and the Coast Guard and the fire services, you know, it took them a long time before they could get the boat stabilised to stop it sinking. And now they have got a hell of a job, Fergal, to try and get that back. They say they will. You know, they've got to replace all the electronics. They've got to replace all the hydraulic systems. They'll have to NDT test or X-ray test the entire boat to see that it's structurally sound. The word from the camp is that they are ahead of schedule and they are going to be back on the water. But the electronics and software and everything is so sophisticated that it requires, you know, lengthy periods of time to calibrate it and get it all to work properly. So if, as Terry Hutchinson said, if they do get it back together, it'll be an incredible story, you know.
And this is just the preliminary round for the actual America's Cup itself, because they're fighting it out to see who's going to face New Zealand in the actual event.
Yeah, yeah. This is the Prada Cup. And the winner of the Prada Cup is the team that gets selected to challenge the New Zealanders to race for the America's Cup itself. So if you like, the Prada Cup is the selection series that selects the challenger, and then they go forward in February to race the New Zealanders.
Thanks to Maurice O'Connell, and we'll have him back to discuss the America's Cup again. If you want to watch any of that event, it's all over YouTube for free. And that's it for Seascapes for this week. We're back at the same time next Friday. Everything on the programme is podcast. It's on our website, rte.ie/seascapes. If you want to contact me or the programme, the email is seascapes@rte.ie. If you're anywhere on or near the water over the next week, stay safe.